The feeling came from nowhere, so you assumed it came from here. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show, and I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought. So today, folks, we are diving deep with just me. Okay, you're getting a solo episode today. And we are going to be talking about one of the hallmark symptoms of complex PTSD. And honestly, the single most miserable part of this whole adult child thing, emotional flashbacks. Now, I did a solo episode on this back in December of 2023. It's episode 141. And that's probably my most popular solo episode that I've ever done. I got amazing feedback on that episode. But I want to refresh you on what I told you in that episode, specifically what I told you about what was going on with me. So I shared that I had had a brutal year. I walked you through April, May, and June of 2023, which was this stretch where it was just hit after hit after hit, one thing after the next, and every single one of them landing directly on my abandonment wound and ripping it completely wide open and showing me that I was not as healed as I thought that I was. But what I didn't tell you in that episode was what was actively going on in my life that day as I sat down and I recorded it. What had happened after June of 2023 and what was actively going on in my life when I sat there and recorded that episode was I was in the most insane trauma-bonded relationship of my life with an active alcoholic. It was absolutely fucking brutal. And I didn't end up sharing any of that until this past September in my first episode back after taking almost a year-long break from the podcast. And I'm not going to go into that whole story again in this episode. If you want to hear that, I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. I'll just say that that's the most vulnerable I've ever felt on this podcast. That is the only time I've ever had a vulnerability hangover from sharing something on this podcast. But what I do want to do is just tell you a little bit more about what was going on right then and there as I was recording episode 141 in that moment. I'm not sure if I shared this in episode 201, but this gentleman, this guy, he lived out of town. And so anytime that I would, you know, try to go home, I would just go into the most intense emotional flashbacks. Like I would become completely non-functional. I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. And so it was actually better for me to be there where he lives in the chaos, in the drinking, in the fighting, because at least there I could be like somewhat functional. And so there I was, folks, recording episode 141, sitting in the conference room of the building that he lived in, recording an episode telling you all about how to, you know, recognize an emotional flashback and how to get out of one while he was upstairs drinking or passed out or who the hell knows what. So yeah, I'm going to call out the irony there, okay? Because it's not lost on me. It's not lost on me. But here's what I knew, though, even then. That is number one, while I was in the midst of this, I knew that this was happening so that I could heal. Two, I knew that this was happening so that one day I could share about it and help others heal. And three, I knew that talking about it publicly while I was in the midst of it was not the right thing to do. You know, you needed me to be resourced enough to be able to hold down this fort and not, you know, processing my own act of crisis in front of you all. So that is what was going on that day. And wait until you hear what happened after that, which you'll hear shortly. But so today we are going to be taking a much deeper, a much more in-depth look at emotional flashbacks. And this time, you're going to get it from an Andrea who is not currently in one. From an Andrea who's not currently in an emotional flashback. From an Andrea who's done a hell of a lot of work since then and has a hell of a lot more to say about this than I did back in December of 2023. So let's get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket. There's a chat that's available to you 24/7. We have a ton of subgroups that are on various struggles or interests like shit show parenting, employment struggles, childhood sexual abuse survivors, neurodivergent issues. There's an IFS group, divorce and separation. What else do we have? Healing from narcissists. You name it, we got it, okay? So this is relational trauma, and we heal relational trauma through safe relationships. This is where you can do so for less than a damn dollar a day. So you, yes, you, yes, you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever. How about we do it today? Okay, how about we do it? You can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow, or you can see the link in the show notes next. Give me a follow on Insta and TikTok at adultchildpod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all. So let's set the baseline on what the hell an emotional flashback actually is. Now, most of y'all are probably already familiar with this, but just in case anybody is new to this, let's just start here. So put simply, an emotional flashback is when something in the present sets you off and you get catapulted back in time to feeling exactly how you felt as a kid. So not remembering it, but feeling it in your body right now. And this term comes from Pete Walker. He's a psychotherapist. He wrote Complex PTSD: From Surviving to Thriving, which is basically the Bible on all of this shit. And he's the one who really put language to all of this. And his definition of an emotional flashback is a sudden and often prolonged regression into the feeling states of your abusive or neglectful childhood. And the part that makes these things so confusing, and the reason that so many of us, myself included, go years and years and years without knowing that this is what we're experiencing, is that there's no visual element to this flashback. You know, when most people hear the word flashback, they think of a war veteran hearing a car backfire, and all of a sudden they are seeing a war scene play out in their mind. And that is a completely different thing, okay? That is a traditional PTSD flashback. With an emotional flashback, there is no visual component to it. There is nothing that says, hey, this is about your past, or this is about something that you experienced as a kid. It is purely emotion. So you have no reason to think it's about anything other than what is happening right in front of you in that moment. And so these feeling states that Pete Walker is talking about, he calls them a melange, meaning it's not just one clean emotion. There is usually a mixture of emotions going on. And the emotions that show up the most are fear, toxic shame, despair, and sadness. But what's most important to note here is that the intensity of these flashbacks, there's quite a wide range, okay? So on the subtle end, you know, let's say something happens and you have a reaction to it, but it doesn't completely derail you. Like, you're still functioning, you're still able to go about your day. There's just this thing that you're carrying that's a little bigger than the situation called for. And then we go on the more intense end, where you are experiencing sheer terror, okay? Not fear, not anxiety, terror. Like, you feel like you're going to die. You're completely non-functional. You can't focus on anything. There's no thinking your way out of it. It is just terror. It's the certainty that there's something so deeply wrong with you. There's this total hopelessness, like nothing is ever going to change and you're never going to feel better ever again. And what I've noticed is that it's really that abandonment wound getting hit that produces the most debilitating, destabilizing, miserable flashbacks. And so just like there is a wide range in the intensity of what you're feeling in these flashbacks, same goes for how long they can last. Now, some might be over in a few minutes, And some might run for days. And Pete Walker talks about how these can turn into what he calls extended regressions, where you're in it for weeks or longer. I kind of feel like I was in and out of I was in an emotional flashback for almost like a year. I mean, it wasn't solid. There were breaks from it, but from like April 2023 to April 2020, I feel like I was just living in one big old emotional flashback. So now let's talk about like what the hell is actually going on here? Like what is happening in your brain in these moments? And for me, learning this was one of the single most relieving things that has ever happened to me because, you know, when you're in one of these, when you're in an emotional flashback, it really feels like you are losing your fucking mind. It's like completely irrational. Somebody doesn't text you back and all of a sudden you feel like you are going to die. And on top of that feeling like I'm going to die, it's like you hate yourself for being so dramatic. Like in your head, you know that the reaction that you're experiencing does not match the situation at hand, but knowing that in your head doesn't make you feel any better. And so understanding that there was an actual mechanism lying underneath this, that helped me so, so much to break through so much shame. And so there are one of two things that could be going on here. So the first is that a fragmented memory is getting triggered. And the second is that there's no memory involved at all. It's just straight conditioning. It's your nervous system got trained. And so I'm going to walk you through both of these. So the first, the fragmented memory getting triggered. And this is the one that's best understood. This is the one that you've probably heard about. Most of y'all are probably already familiar with this. I've talked about this many times on the podcast. But again, just in case anybody is brand new to this, I will just briefly walk you through this. So when something happens that sends you into fight-flight mode, the emotional part of your brain revs way the hell up, and the rational thinking part of your brain shuts down. Now, that thinking part of your brain, that is the part of your brain that's responsible for taking all of the bits of data from that experience, everything you saw, heard, felt, everything that happened, and assembles it into a clear and cohesive memory with a beginning, middle, and end, a story, something that you can look back at and go, oh, that happened, you know, and then it's over. But that can't happen when the thinking part of your brain is offline. So instead, and this is especially true for kids, when there's nobody there helping them to make sense of what they just experienced, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that more shortly, that experience just gets stored in your brain, your body, your nervous system as loose bits of information, as fragments, not as a memory. And what's in those fragments is everything you took in, what you saw, what you heard, what you smelled, what it felt like in your body, the emotions that you were feeling, that sheer terror, that shame, that despair, as well as the meaning that you made out of the experience. So what you decided in that moment about yourself, about other people, about the world, and I want to sit with that one for a second because that's the piece that does the most damage. You know, a kid can't think, wow, my mom is really struggling right now and this has nothing to do with me. Like, that's not available to them, okay? They're not thinking that. So they land somewhere else. They land with, I'm too much. I'm not worth sticking around for. If I were different, this wouldn't be happening. And that conclusion doesn't get just stored as an opinion that you formed one time. It gets stored as a fact about you. So what that fragment lights up 30 years later, you're not just feeling the terror and the shame. You're getting the verdict too. And that's the toxic shame that I was talking about earlier. So then you get into adulthood and something happens that is reminiscent of this, that triggers this, and that lights up this fragmented memory. And all of a sudden, you're feeling the exact same feelings that you felt when you experienced that for the first time. You're catapulted back in time and you are reliving it. Except that since it's not a clear and cohesive memory, there's nothing to see here. There's no picture. There's no scene. There's nothing that tells you that this is old, that tells you you're flashing back to something that you experienced as a kid. And so the only conclusion available to you is to think that this is about right here and right now. Now, here's the other thing that could be going on, and this one is for everybody out there listening who says, you know, my childhood was quote unquote not that bad. You know, there were no big scary moments. My parents never did anything I could specifically point to. I don't have some terrible thing that I can trace back to. So I am talking to you for a minute because you know what? A lot of emotional flashbacks actually don't come from one big terrifying moment at all. A lot of them come from the small stuff, the stuff that was repeated, the criticism you got over and over, that low-grade rejection, being dismissed, being talked over, that look on somebody's face, those everyday moments that on their own were not dramatic enough to send a kid into fight flight. So then how does something that small end up producing something so big so many years later? Well, it works completely different. With the fragmented memory piece I just walked you through, you know, you need that shutdown to happen. That thinking brain has to go offline so that experience never gets filed properly. But with the small repeated stuff, it doesn't need any of that. None of that has to happen. Your nervous system just learns. You went through that pattern, that criticism, that dismissal, that rejection, whatever particular flavor was yours, hundreds of times, maybe thousands. And your body compiled all of it into a blueprint. And what's on that blueprint is this. It learned what danger feels like. And for you, danger is a certain tone of voice or a pause before somebody answers you or a door closing a little too hard. It learned what to expect, which is that it's coming and that you should be watching for it. And it learns something about you, which is the same verdict as before, that you're too much, that you're not worth staying for, and that if you were different, that this wouldn't be happening. So there was no single moment that had to be catastrophic. The repetition itself did the encoding. And so there you are now, a grown adult, and something happens that hits that blueprint, and you're in the whole thing, the fear, the shame, the hopelessness, the grief. And you go looking for the moment it's attached to, and you can't find one. And that's not because you're making it up or because it wasn't that bad. It's because there was never one moment. What you're feeling is the sum of all of them all at once. All right, shit shows, do you ever have those days where everything takes you three times longer than you thought it would? I'll be honest, I have those days multiple times a week. And so then 6 p.m. rolls around and I've checked off like half my to-do list, and going to the grocery store is one of those things I've yet to do. Now, this is usually the moment that my inner critic loves to come in to start shaming me about how irresponsible I am, how I can't get it together, what the hell's wrong with me. But then I remember I have Omaha steaks in the freezer, and the critic no longer has a dinner crisis to shame me over. Now, having Omaha steaks in the freezer is like having a trusted butcher in a gourmet food shop right in my house. And let's talk about the flavor of these steaks, okay? Because when I buy steak at the grocery store, unless I marinate them ahead of time, it usually comes out kind of flavorless. But with Omaha steaks, I don't have to do a damn thing. No marinating, no planning, no thinking ahead. It is flavorful all on its own. And there's also a nostalgic thing going on for me because my grandma, my dad's mom, she always gave us Omaha steaks every Christmas. And she was one of the few people that I felt truly unconditionally loved by. So there is a warmth to this that goes beyond just the way that they taste. Omaha steaks has been around for over 100 years. It is the same damn beef people have trusted in their kitchen for generations, shipped nationwide straight to your damn door, arriving frozen, ready for grilling, searing, and roasting with minimal time and effort. I personally like to cook my steaks in the air fryer. So traditionally I've been a ribeye gal, but let me tell you about what I most recently got, the Burger Perfection Flight. For just $79.99, you get 20 premium steak burgers crafted from 5 distinct cuts of steak. So you can try the Burger Perfection Flight at Omaha Steaks today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get 35% off with promo code BEEF. So that's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for 35% off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. So I said at the very beginning of this episode that this is the podcast where we talk about what to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought. Well, that moment came for me after experiencing an emotional flashback. Okay, I was 7 years sober, and after dating a guy for less than a month, he ghosted me, and my reaction was as if my husband of 30 years had just tragically died in a plane crash. If you want to hear that whole story, go listen to my very first episode, Why I'll Never Date Another Guy Named Brian. But so this was not the first time that I had felt this feeling, but this was the first time that I had these realizations as a result of having that feeling. Number one being that there's no way that the way that I'm feeling right now could actually be about this guy. And number two was the realization that this is the same exact feeling that I felt when I woke up in the middle of the night at 9 years old, and I felt like I was going to die if I couldn't sleep in my mom's bed. And in fact, I think that that experience at 9 years old was actually the first time that I experienced an emotional flashback. I think that that was an emotional flashback to something that I had experienced 2 years prior. So as many of y'all know, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mom was an alcoholic. I found out that my mom was an alcoholic when I was 7 years old. And so shortly after I found this out, so it was one night, my dad was out of town for work. And whenever my dad went out of town for work, I would fall asleep in my own bed. And in the middle of the night, when I'd wake up to pee, I've always been somebody that has never slept through the night. I've always been somebody that wakes up in the middle of the night to pee. When I'd wake up in the middle of the night, I would then go and sleep in my mom's bed for the rest of the night. And it was like a fun thing. It was like a sleepover in mom's bed. Like, I even remember that I would tape a piece of paper on top of the toilet cover, like toilet seat cover, that would say, mom's bed, I guess, like just in case I would forget to go in there or something. So it was one of these nights, my dad was out of town. I woke up, I saw the little sign on my toilet, and I walked into her bedroom and all of the lights were on and the bed was made. And I went downstairs to find her, you know, passed out, drunk, and on the couch, and then proceeded to essentially carry her up the stairs and get her into bed. Now, I'm not sure how many times that happened. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened more than once, but I do remember just the sheer terror that I felt when I walked into that room and I saw all the lights on and I saw that the bed was still made. And so, as I said before, a kid goes into fight flight and the emotional part of their brain revs up and the rational thinking part of their brain shuts down. And unless an adult helps them to process what it is that they experienced, that is going to get stored as a fragmented memory in their body and their mind and their nervous system, and is at risk for causing emotional flashbacks down the road. Now, I did not have a healthy adult that helped me to process what it is that I had experienced, but I want to talk about what that would have looked like. What would it have looked like if there actually had been a healthy adult who knew what I'd been through and sat down with me the next day? First thing is, you don't lead with the conversation. You first settle the kid's body. So you don't come in hot the next morning with, like, you know, we need to talk about what happened last night. You get them comfortable, you get them fed, you get them somewhere safe, because a kid cannot process something scary from a state of alarm. You know, the conversation has to be from a place of calm. And then you open the door. Okay, you don't shove them through it. It's something like, last night was kind of scary, huh? You know, do you want to tell me about it? And if they say no, you don't push. You leave it open. You know, that's okay. We can talk about it whenever you want. Because forcing a kid to relive something before they're ready just re-scares them. And then, and this is the important part, you let them tell it in their words, however it comes out. Messy, out of order, weird, whatever, and you don't correct, you don't rush, you don't fill it in for them. And here is why that's the important part mechanically. These fragments, these feelings, these images, sensations, the no story, the telling it out loud in order to a calm adult is literally what stitches those fragments into a memory. That is the processing right there. It's not you explaining it to them. It's them putting it into words while you sit there and you don't come apart. It's you staying calm in that moment. So if they're jumping all over the place, you know, you help them lay it in order gently. So you woke up, and then what happened? You know, and then what did you do? Beginning, middle, and end, out loud, because that's what turns it from something that's still happening into something that happened. And a finished story is something the brain can actually file away. And as it's coming out, you know, you name the feelings and you make them normal. That sounds really scary. Of course you were scared. Like anybody would have been scared. Kids don't have the words yet. And so when you hand them the word, you know, the feeling becomes something that they can hold instead of a nameless flood. And you're teaching them that their reaction made sense, that it is not evidence that something is wrong with them. And then you catch the meaning, and this one is everything, because that kid has already privately, unconsciously decided something about what happened. You know, they always have, and it's almost always some version of, this is my fault. So you listen for it and you correct it out loud. None of that was your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. You know, that was a grown-up thing, and it was never your job to fix. And then you land it somewhere safe. You know, you don't leave the conversation hanging in the fear. You end it with, like, you're safe now. And anytime something scares you, you come find me and we'll figure it out together. Because however it ends, you know, that's what the nervous system keeps, what it holds on to. And then you let them come back to it. You know, one conversation doesn't finish it. You know, over the next few days or however long, however it needs to be, you know, they'll bring it up again, retell it, ask more questions, you know, and that's not them being stuck. That's the brain metabolizing it. So every calm retelling drains a little more of the charge out of it. And the engine of that entire thing is a kid putting the experience into words out loud in order in front of a calm adult who is not rattled by it. That is what takes a raw, wordless, body-level terror and turns it into a clear and cohesive memory. And so that's obviously not what happened with me, right? Nobody sat down with me the next day. Nobody helped me make sense of what I had just experienced. And so that experience got stored as fragments, as terror with no story attached to it. And I don't know if that was the only time that that ever happened. I think it's highly likely that it happened more than once, okay? But even setting that aside, every single time my mom got drunk was an instance of her abandoning me. And that's the thing about growing up with an alcoholic or addicted parent. You know, it really creates this very specific kind of abandonment wound because you're being abandoned by somebody who's standing right in front of you. Like she's there, she's in the house, she's technically present, but she's gone. And I was constantly on guard, never knowing when it was going to happen next. But let's fast forward to being 9 years old, and I wake up in the middle of the night, and I am hit with this overwhelming feeling like I am going to die if I could not sleep in my mom's bed. And you know, like my dad was in town that night, right? Like my mom wasn't drunk. Nothing was happening. There was nothing going on in that moment that I needed to be afraid of. And that's what makes it a flashback, right? Like simply waking up in the middle of the night was the trigger. And let's talk about how that was handled, okay? Because the way that this got handled did more damage than just that one experience, okay? So my parents were extremely frustrated with me, especially my dad, because it happened the next night and it happened the next night and it happened the next night. I kept waking up in the middle of the night and feeling like I was going to die if I couldn't sleep in my mom's bed. And I remember one of those nights, my dad actually physically shoving me back into my room. You know, that's the only time either of my parents ever got physical with me. It was not a pattern, but it happened. And so this kept going on every night. And eventually they just sort of like threw in the towel. Like I'd wake up in the middle of the night, I'd go in their room, I'd tap my dad on the shoulder and he would just switch spots with me and he'd go sleep in my own bed. And then after this going on for however long, I don't know how long, one day I walked into school. I remember I was in the fourth grade. I walked into school and a kid came up to me first thing that day and he said, CJ says you sleep in bed with your mom every night. Well, my dad had played tennis with CJ's dad the night before. So let's just be clear about what was and what wasn't a secret in my family. Because my mom's alcoholism, that was a secret. My parents fighting, that was a secret. Nobody outside of the house knew a goddamn thing about any of that but me, the 9-year-old the 9-year-old needing to sleep in her mother's bed, that one made it around the country club. And eventually I got sent to a therapist, a child psychologist, to deal with this separation anxiety. And when I was a teenager, I remember asking my mom, hey, did you ever tell that therapist that you were an alcoholic? Did you ever tell her that you and dad fought all the time? Her answer was, no, it didn't seem relevant. So there I am, 9 years old, sitting in an office with a professional whose entire job is to figure out what's wrong with me. And the single most relevant fact about my life has been withheld from her, which means the only thing left in that room was to diagnose me. And in that moment, I became the identified patient of my family. I was the one who carried the dysfunction while everyone else got to keep pretending like there was nothing wrong, like they didn't have a problem, because I was the official problem. And so what got installed in me was this belief that there was something pathologically wrong with me. And it wasn't that I was bad. It wasn't that I was stupid or incapable or unlovable. It was quieter than all of that, and honestly, worse than all of that, and not conscious. And it was that at my core, at the very bottom of me, there is something so inherently wrong with me, and it discounts everything that is good about me. And it doesn't matter what I accomplish. It doesn't matter what anybody says about me. At my core, there is something so fundamentally fucked up about me. And then I spent the next 20 years like living out that wound over and over again, because that's what happened. You know, I had that experience over and over and over again. That was essentially a reenactment of that original thing with my mom, of being abandoned out of nowhere with no sort of warning. And honestly, I think that is one of the main reasons that I picked up drugs and alcohol, was to make that feeling stop, because it is absolutely unbearable. But then I got sober, and now I have nothing to numb that pain, to turn that feeling off. And of course, my picker is screwed up, right? You know, as I say, we don't enter the rooms of sobriety with high self-esteem or a long history of of healthy relationships. So I'm picking emotionally unavailable men. I'm choosing active alcoholics. You know, I'm choosing the people who are guaranteed to hit that exact wound. And the pattern was always the same. I'd be fine until that first instant where either they took too long to get back to me, or I just felt like the tiniest shift in interest in them, and that would trigger my fear of abandonment. And I go into one of these emotional flashbacks. And every time it was more intense than it was the time before. And this is something that Pete Walker actually talks specifically about these layers, about how each one of these emotional flashbacks stacks on top of the last one. And so by the time, you know, you're 30-something, it's happened to you so many times, you're not just feeling what that 9-year-old felt or that 7-year-old felt. You're feeling what that 7 and 9-year-old and every other single instant that I had ever experienced that. Which brings me to the most intense emotional flashback that I have ever experienced in my entire life. And it happened about a month after I recorded that episode on emotional flashbacks, episode 141. So that was when, beginning of December. So fast forward to my birthday, January 27th. I'd been home for a few days after a quite chaotic stretch over Christmas and New Year's. And so it's my birthday, and he forgets it's my birthday. Like, he genuinely forgets it's my birthday. And so when I called him out over it over text, well, he like didn't even call me, right? Like, he didn't call, I'm sure because he was like wasted or passed out or had no memory of me telling her or whatever it was. But that was actually the thing that did it for me. Like, that was the moment where I was like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, what the hell am I doing here? I'm not doing this anymore. And so the next day we talked on the phone, and I set a boundary with him, and I told him, so stupid, I told him that we were not going to communicate for 1 week. You know, I said, take this week and think about your drinking. So dumb. That's what I said, okay? And so that was a Sunday. And I felt really good. I'm like, all right, I'm doing this. And Monday, I felt really good too. And then I don't know if it was Tuesday or Wednesday, but I just woke up one of those days and I just freaked the fuck out. Okay. I just freaked the fuck out. I went into an emotional flashback. I texted him first thing in the morning to try to squash that. Right. I didn't hear from him. And then just as the day went on, it just got worse and worse and worse until I was just like, it was horrible. And I just remember driving across a bridge and just thinking to myself, you know, should I just drive over this bridge? You know, should I just drive straight into a tree? And I want to be clear that I wasn't, you know, planning anything, but I was in that car, like genuinely thinking about this. I was just, I cannot survive this. I cannot survive this feeling. It was the most miserable feeling I have ever felt in my life. And so I want you to understand what was actually happening in that car, because on paper, here's what occurred. I had not spoken to a man for 2 days. A man who was an active alcoholic who had just forgotten my birthday. And there were 2 days of not speaking, which was something that I asked for, right? It was a boundary that I set. It was a healthy thing that I did for myself. 2 days. That's all. That's the entire event. But I wasn't in that car as a 30-something-year-old woman who had just set a boundary with an alcoholic. You know, I was that 7-year-old girl who had walked into her mother's bedroom and saw all the lights on and the bed was made. You know, I was that 9-year-old who woke up in the middle of the night certain that she was going to die, plus every other single abandonment flashback that I had experienced since then. All of that was firing at once in the car. And so eventually later that night, he ended up texting me. And the moment that he did, my nervous system settled completely. It's really crazy how that happens, right? It is absolutely wild. And then the next day, I was on a flight there again. And I will say that that was the last stint. That was the end. I was there for about 2 months straight, and I came home and I never went back. And so I want to talk about, what do we actually do with these emotional flashbacks? And there's two pieces that I want to touch on. One is getting through one when you're in it. The other is doing the work on what's actually getting triggered, which makes them smaller and less frequent over time. So let's start with getting through one. And honestly, before we can talk about anything else, there's something that has to come first, and that is developing the skill of being able to recognize that you're in one, because none of the rest of this is available to you until you can do that. Think about it. If you don't know that what's happening is a flashback, then everything you do next is going to be aimed at the wrong thing. You're going to be trying to fix the situation in front of you. And what you're going to do is default to one of your trauma responses. So whichever of the four Fs is your particular flavor, you're going to fight, you're going to flee, you're going to shut down, you're going to fawn, because that is the mechanism that you have been reaching for your entire life. And here's the part that keeps people stuck. Like it can work, right? Like in the short term, that can actually work. That can actually get you out of a flashback. You get that relief. But if you got out by reaching for the wrong thing, every time you do that, you're reinforcing it. You're making it more automatic. So the next time this happens, you're going to reach for it faster and harder, and you're a little further from ever addressing what's actually underneath that. Because ultimately, the goal here is not to get these feelings to stop. That's what we've been doing our whole lives. That's what every one of these defenses is. The goal isn't to get better at escaping it. The goal is to be able to be with what's coming up, to stay with it, because that's the thing that actually lets it heal. So the first thing we have to be able to do here is be able to tell that we're in one. So how do you tell you're in one? Well, let's start at the most extreme end, because I just went there, suicidal ideation. If you are suddenly thinking about not being here anymore, that is very often a flashback. You know, Pete Walker talks about this. It's a call for help from a much younger part of you, not a verdict on your life. Then there's the obvious one, which is, you know, that your reaction does not match the situation at hand. Pete Walker describes this as a small mistake feeling like an emergency, or some minor thing feeling like a genuine travesty of justice. Another thing is feeling small, feeling young, helpless, fragile, like you are a little kid in a grown adult's body. That is one of the most direct tells. Another is your inner critic is getting significantly more vicious than it normally is. So not the regular background noise that you deal with. The volume goes way the hell up and it is cruel. Another is time distortion. So Pete Walker calls this eternity thinking. You know, the feeling that this will never end. Extreme black and white thinking. I'm going to feel like this forever. A future where you feel differently is not just unlikely, it's genuinely unimaginable. It's genuinely unimaginable to you in that moment. And then suddenly launching into a trauma response out of nowhere. So all of a sudden you find yourself picking a fight, or you've cleaned the entire house, or you've been on your phone for hours and hours and you don't know where the time went, or you're suddenly managing everybody else's feelings. And the reason that's a sign is that those are all defenses, right? We just talked about this. They're what you reach for when something is too painful to be with. So if one kicks on and you can't say why, something underneath it obviously got triggered. And look, again, this is a skill. It takes time. It takes practice. And in the beginning, you're probably only going to be able to see this in hindsight. You come out the other side and the day later and go, oh, that's what that was. And that counts, right? That's still progress. But the goal is to eventually be able to catch yourself while you're in it. And so the first step in managing any emotional flashback is just being able to say it out loud. I'm having a flashback. That's it. That's step one. And when you are in a less extreme flashback, simply being able to say that out loud can genuinely make a huge difference. Like just naming it can be enough to start pulling you out of it. But I want to be honest with you about the other end of it, because when you are in a very, very intense flashback, you know, if you're in one of these abandonment flashbacks, when you're feeling like you're going to die, saying I'm having a flashback really does not make you feel any better, okay? Hate to break it to you. I mean, it does make it slightly more bearable somehow just to know what's happening to you. But your like body does not care that you named it, okay? Nothing in your body changes. And this is such a surreal thing to experience in yourself, because like in your head, you see the whole thing. You know exactly what set it off. You know this is old. You know that the way you feel does not actually match what's in front of you. And none of it matters, you know? Your body is still doing what it's doing. And so watching your head and your body be that far apart is wild. And it's the moment you really do understand what people mean when they say the body keeps the score. And so from here, after we've, you know, acknowledged it, recognize we're in a flashback, the next piece is somatic, you know, getting back into your body, slowing your breathing down, relaxing your muscles, because tension itself sends danger signals to your brain. So slowing down in general, because, you know, rushing presses the panic button, you know, so getting yourself somewhere safe, cold water movement, whatever works for you. I'm not going to spend a whole time running through a whole list. But what I do want to name is that about these tools, about these somatic tools, you know, when you're really in it, when you're in a really intense flashback, reaching for one of like trying to do somatic work can feel virtually impossible. You know, you're supposed to breathe or do whatever, and you really just can't get yourself to do anything. And so if this has been your experience, like you're not doing it wrong. It just means that you're at a point which these certain tools are just not reachable. And that's exactly why this next piece matters so much. When you're flooded, pick up the damn phone and call somebody. I mean it. And I want to say something about why too, because it's not just about not being alone in it, though that truly is important. But the other piece of it is like when you're in a flashback, the thinking part of your brain is offline. So, you know, you cannot be your own perspective in that moment. It's not available to you. And so what another person can do is to be that for you until yours comes back online. And so I've had two experiences in the past week or so where I was on the phone with somebody who was clearly in the middle of an emotional flashback. You know, they reached out because they were struggling, and I was able to say to them right then and there, hey, like you're in an emotional flashback right now. And I want to say this really clearly because I know how many of you are going to need to hear it. Calling somebody is not you being needy. It's not you being dependent. It's not you being a burden or too much or failing at handling your shit on your own. What else can you do if you're in one of these? Pete Walker talks about turning toward your inner child. And for me, turning towards the part of me that's activated. And I think that this is like the skill after recognition. So it's not just being able to say I'm in an emotional flashback. It's being able to say there is a part of me that is in an emotional flashback. And that shift is subtle, but honestly, I think it's even more powerful because the first one still has you kind of fused with it, right? The second one gives you an inch of space. And I'll be honest, IFS did not come naturally to me at first. This is a skill that I have had to cultivate, and it's taken me a really long time, but I can tell you it's been one of the most impactful things that I've learned how to do. It's curiosity, and I just mean actual curiosity. I'm not trying to change you. I'm not trying to fix you. I'm not trying to make you go away. I'm not even trying to help you right now. I just want to understand you. I want to know what's going on with you. So that is all the in-the-moment stuff. Now let's talk about the actual work on what's underneath. The work that's actually going to allow the intensity and the frequency of these things to actually decrease. And so the first piece is getting an understanding of what your triggers are. What are the triggers that are sending you into an emotional flashback? Because your triggers are pointing you toward what needs to be healed. So let's look at the most common triggers, and I'm going to break them down into four categories. And the first category is sensory, a sound, a smell, a taste, a texture, a look on somebody's face. Then there is the relational triggers. So somebody withdrawing or going quiet, you know, that unanswered text, a shorter than usual reply, somebody who suddenly seems distant, criticism or feedback, even mild, even kind, the stuff that nobody says out loud, a look, a tone, a shift in somebody's mood, conflict in arguments, raised voices, even a completely reasonable disagreement. Feeling unseen or dismissed, being talked over, being overlooked, being treated like your presence is optional, feeling like a burden, that sense that your needs are too much, that you're an inconvenience for asking. And then there are situational triggers. So unpredictability, plans changing last minute, not knowing what's coming next, chaos. Feeling trapped, so stuck in a meeting or on a plane in traffic, making a mistake, even privately, even if nobody saw it. Being sick or vulnerable or dependent, so needing help, medical stuff, having to rely on people. And then there's the counterintuitive one, which is success, you know, being celebrated, being seen because of standing out or doing well got you punished or resented growing up. Praise is not safe. So if something good has ever happened and you immediately felt like garbage and had no idea why, this might be why. This might be what it was. And then the fourth category of trigger is your inner critic. And this is one of the defining features of CPTSD, that the thoughts in your head can send you into one of these emotional flashbacks all on their own. There's two ways this plays out, okay? So the first is that something external does happen, but on its own, it isn't big enough to send you into an emotional flashback. Maybe somebody's a little short with you, you make a mistake, and your critic grabs it and runs with it. And by the time it's done with you, you're in one, you know? So the external thing didn't put you there, but your inner critic did. And the second way that this could happen is that there's no external thing at all. It's like a thought comes up or you notice a feeling in your body or a memory surfaces and your critic gets going and you're in an emotional flashback. Your inner critic is your internal abuser. It's the voice of whoever spoke to you that way when you were a kid. And that's exactly why it sends you into a flashback. So all these triggers, these are your breadcrumbs. These are your arrows pointing at what in you needs to be healed. And how you actually go about doing that? Well, there are so many different modalities and we could be here all day going through them all. So I'm just going to tell you what has been most impactful for me, somatic work, nervous system work, and parts work. So covered a lot of ground, but this is the part that I really want you to walk away with. And that is that emotional flashbacks are not evidence that you're not healing. They are not evidence that you're going backwards. And I'm saying this because that is exactly what your inner critic is going to tell you about emotional flashbacks. Pete Walker talks about how survivors read every single flashback as proof that nothing has changed, that they're hopeless, that, you know, all or nothing thinking. I'm either completely fixed or I'm right back where I started. That's not how any of this works. And the goal here is not to get to a place where you are never going to have another flashback again and for the rest of your life. Because guess what? That's not realistic and it isn't the target. But what actually can change is the frequency and the intensity and how long they last and how fast you recognize what's happening and how quickly you come out of them. And Pete Walker calls this a salvation fantasy, this idea that recovery means arriving at some place where you're never going to be triggered ever again. That as long as you're holding on to this belief, you know, every single flashback becomes proof that you failed, which is just going to make the flashback even worse. Every flashback is an opportunity. It is something that hasn't been processed yet. It is a message from a younger part of you about what still hurts. It is a chance to practice doing for yourself what nobody ever did for you. And when something surfaces, it is because you finally have the capacity to face it. Your system does not hand you things you can't hold. So that is all, folks, and I hope that this was an even better episode of Emotional Flashbacks, because Andrea was not in Emotional Flashback while she was recording. Thanks, love you.
Don't let it all go.